This is Kate Magruder with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll be hearing from John Scharfenberger of Philo, whose name has become synonymous with world-famous sparkling wine and fine chocolate. But in the early 1970s, John was just one of hundreds of young people who were drawn to Mendocino County for the wide-open opportunities it offered. For John, the place turned out to be a perfect match to his own ethos, a desire to work the land in collaboration with others, building and growing and producing things that make life more fun. Those seeds were planted early in life as he grew up free-range with his five siblings in the 50s and 60s. John developed a keen sense of curiosity and play on a rare expanse of rural land in Los Angeles County. His passion was building dams and forts and witnessing the miracle of nature.
When I was still in high school, I took some marijuana seeds out of a baggie that I had with pot in it and planted those seeds. And my little brothers and I grew them, and they became huge plants. It was so amazing to be able to just put something in the ground and have something so well valued by us and so easy to get. And so what a wonder. I always wanted to be a rancher. So my interest was actually trying to, in a way, undo all the things I saw going on in the developed part of Los Angeles, all the million tract homes and strip malls and whatnot that were being built while I was a kid. My best friends from high school ended up at UC Santa Cruz, and they got involved with Alan Chadwick's biodynamics garden thing. So I spent all my weekends and holidays down in Santa Cruz with them and working in the garden under Chadwick and learning all kinds of things. So it was during that period of time we all hatched all these crazy plans to maybe start a commune one day. My big idea was to grow marijuana, and we could make enough money to start a vineyard and maybe a winery someday. And so Bonny Doon, which is the area we were living in, was really well suited to certain kinds of grapes. It's since been planted by those. There's nothing there then. And in the same book that recommended Bonny Doon, they also said Philo, California was another great place for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, in a place that hadn't been really proven much.
John never forgot about Philo, which would become, years later, the birthplace of Scharfenberger Cellars, where he would produce the first sparkling wines from Anderson Valley. But for the moment, John's primary goal was simply to find a piece of property to start growing grapes.
My father called me and he said, "You know, John, I think I'm getting really interested in finding a piece of property." I had been looking all along, but everything was so expensive. Napa Valley was so overrun. We're talking 1972. It was overrun and not a place you could farm, I thought, because there's just too much else going on. And there's parts of Sonoma that were okay, but I hadn't really looked too much up in Mendocino County, but I was living near Cloverdale. So I was driving up to Ukiah once and I saw a sign on a post saying for sale. And I called the guy, this is right after my father had told me this, so I was looking. And I called it, and his name was Page Myard. And he was one of the original Myards that kind of settled and took care of the timberland in between here and Yorkville. Wonderful old guy. He showed me a property that looked not like it was going to work out. We were driving towards Lakeport, and I was like, there's no wine area, in the mountains near Lakeport. But he said, you just wait. And then by, chance of topography, there was this wonderful upland shelf of great soils about 1,000 feet above Ukiah in elevation with an amazing view with lots of places for water developing. And vineyards had been put in there in the 1880s, but it kind of went out of business in the Prohibition. So we knew it could be done. So I told my father that. He and my mom, flew right up and looked at it. And my father said, "Yes, that's what I want. That's a ranch I would love to live on when I get older." And what a perfect place. And the price was under $200 an acre. It was like nothing. It was a lot then. But he bought the property. He said, "John, do you want to caretake it for a few years until we figure out what we're going to do? Kind of come up with a plan, and I'll hire you to help me." And so I did. I had the next 5 years of my life learning the hard way how to fix tractors and grow grapes and all the great stuff that goes with fixing things and making things work. Up to that point, I'd never changed the oil in my truck, so I was really far behind having to learn a lot. So it was a really great learning experience to to learn how to take tractors apart and put them back together. The ranch was about a half an hour away from Ukiah, so it was pretty, it wasn't very convenient if you ran out of things. So I made a plan to plant the vineyards over time. We were going to plant, you know, little by little, and over 10 years we would finish planting it. So the first group was done, and I was, you know, looking at all the interesting things, like how do you do everything. I had a consultant working with me, and then I just read a little article about something called drip irrigation. You know, I said, Alex, could we put drip irrigation in there? And he said, you know, I don't think they've done it yet in California, but maybe down here in Napa. So he asked, he said, yeah, there's somebody doing it in Napa. So I figured out how to find the parts for it, a guy over in Arbuckle, California, and I bought what I needed, which is this really jerry-rigged kind of weird irrigation system. But I put in the first drip irrigation on grapes, you know, and certainly in Mendocino County, and it worked really well. So it was really fun.
Did you get raised eyebrows? Did people give you a hard time about that, or did people catch on pretty quickly?
No, it's hard to say. You know, I was kind of a newcomer, and I was from Berkeley, and I had long hair and a beard. You know, basically the irrigation places and the tractor places and the welding shops hadn't seen anybody like me come in and make orders and actually, you know, interact with them on complicated things. So their eyebrows were raised from the time they saw me. And so it was pretty funny to be the first, like, kind of hippie, you know, back to the land, but real farmer. They just didn't, you know, the locals had never seen anything the likes of it. They thought the hippies were the people who lived up in the mountains, and, you know, all the farm boys down here looked like us, you know, but I was the first one that sort of, you know, looked somewhat in the middle. I was definitely, you know, my brain was at Greenfield Ranch, and my profession was working the land at Eagle Point.
As you looked around the community at that time, how did you see Ukiah?
In 1973-74 is when I started, and there was a lot going on in Ukiah. There was lots of little theater things. I remember, you know, kind of doing some music things. Along the road up to my house lived David Raitt and Mark Hansen. So I got to be good friends with them, and then they introduced me into kind of what they were doing. Again, they were kind of new up there as well, into what was going on in Ukiah. And it wasn't too long before I got to know, you know, tons of people, and that there's a whole kind of rather big community of people, you know, from all the ranches, Running Springs and the ones up in Potter Valley and even some down in Hopland. I mean, there was, you know, hundreds of us living in them there hills, and Ukiah was basically our place to go to get stuff and meet each other.
Was there a downside to that whole time? Was there something that was not so pretty?
You know, it was hard living there then. I mean, I didn't have a big problem because I had a job, but I was gay, and there was not a lot of gay, you know, there weren't a lot of gay people around. And if they were, I didn't know how to figure out how to find them, you know. I tried, but failed. And that was, for me, you know, not a problem, but a challenge. And really, I could figure that out by just getting in my car and driving an hour and a half, and, you know, it's no big deal. But I think that the people who lived up there, you know, really were there for reasons of the heart. You know, it's so beautiful and so nourishing to be in a community that was wonderful, and also in an environment where their horticultural interests and their, you know, just being involved in their own food was such a sustainably wonderful thing to be involved with. So I think it was never too tough. Let's put it that way.
So tell me about how you went from growing grapes to making wine.
I became part of a group of winemakers. I wasn't a winemaker, but they all were, who would get together and taste wine every couple weeks. And so it was all the major winemakers from, you know, the wineries in Mendocino County, and a couple of other people from outside. And I was sort of the pedestrian. Was brought in. I was not a trained winemaker, and it was interesting tasting with them. I remember my tastes were very parallel to the common understanding of flavors with almost everything, until we had a tasting about champagne, on French champagnes, and also on some California ones. And I loved the French champagnes. They were so smooth. They were so delightful. They were light. They were crisp. They were, you know, could just go on all night. And the California ones were a little clunky and kind of heavy, especially the ones from Napa Valley. And so when it came onto it, all the winemaker guys were like, loved the California ones and didn't like the French ones, which I thought was so bizarre. And I think maybe I said, well, maybe that's why it's a small industry. people are not making it, you know, in the right places. Right around the same time, I brought this up to Barney Fetzer, and he said to me, you know, John, we're sitting on a, like, heaven for champagne-like wines, Anderson Valley. So I was, like, driving past the gravel pit on Talmadge Road one day, and I thought, oh, my God, I should make champagne or sparkling wines from Anderson Valley grapes because it's so cold over there. And back in the 70s, they were having a lot of trouble ripening their wines. A lot of Cabernets barely could make it, and the Pinot Noirs were thin, and the Chardonnays weren't so hot. I mean, so in a sense, those things would be exactly like the condition in France. In a cold area, you would want coldness. You would want red wines to barely make it because you're trying to grow a grape that has a long time on the vine, but without a lot of heat. So it has much different characteristics. And so I think within about 4 months, I just said, well, I'm going to make champagne. Of course, I didn't know how, and I didn't know how I would get the money to do it. You know, it was just like an idea. So I did a lot of research, and I think that's been what I've done about a lot of things. I've done a lot of research on different things that I wanted to do and then done them. And you learn a lot about, you know, a whole panoply of things that you don't expect to. Did my research, and I talked to a lot of people in Anderson Valley about the growing situation over here. My personal savings, which is about $50,000 at the time, was all I had, but it was enough to really get started. I ordered tanks. We rented some space in near the health club in Ukiah. I got a contract with a vineyard in Anderson Valley to buy grapes at a good price. And my plan was to then have other people help me do it. So the first year, we took the grapes over to Fetzer, and Fetzer did a really interesting pressing that tried to emulate the way they press grapes in Champagne. It was really fun to do that. And then they fermented those things to us until they were just getting going. Then we would take that wine, it was sort of unfinished, and then truck it over to our winery, which is back behind the health club. There we had tanks, and we built our own catwalks, and we built our own a lot of stuff. I mean, so we didn't spend much money on it. So we put the wine there and finished the fermentation. And then the next spring, sat down to really do the blending that's required to make a good champagne. So it was really fun. But we tried to emulate the things that made sense to flavor. And that was the important thing, is the items that make sense to flavor were the things we had to control. So the grapes you use, the type of press you use, how ripe they are at the time. So you take some grapes and you press it hard once and then harder the second time, and you'd separate those two. And so at the end of the day, you had a whole paint box of different flavors to put together into what you wanted. And that's the typical way of making champagne. It's not the typical way of making Cabernet or Pinot Noir or Chardonnay, which are all like one thing, and that thing is sacred. It's a blend. So we proceeded with this, and that was in 1981. And in 1983, we had our first bottles. We took it out to the market. So we were the first manufacturers of sparkling wine from Anderson Valley. It's kind of nice. We beat Roeder by a couple of years, I think. Still, you know, they've done an amazing job too. Anyway, so our wines continued to get better and better and better, but I was getting poorer and poorer and scarier. So one of the things I did learn to do was to work my butt off trying to sell things. That really taught me how to market things and also to try and really think of what the people that I'm selling to want and learn how to articulate the things that make sense to them that are true. And so that was a great part of it. The other part is trying to find money from people who want to invest. And so I was able to get investors into the winery, stay afloat until luckily a French company was looking for a project in California. They tried my wine. They really liked it. They said, can we come and see your winery tomorrow? I gave them the address. They arrived in a helicopter. And they said, you made that wine in this garage? They really wanted to do something. So they were wonderful people. They were the sort of caviar socialists of France. Really had wonderful social interests. In. We did a lot of planting trees. I think I planted 20 or 30,000 trees on the property we had here. And also, we were paying, like today's wages, 20 years ago. And I was. I mean, it was my idea. And we had health care and we had pensions and all that stuff. So it was really great to be able to work that way and feel so good about the fact that we were doing that right. At the same time, the wine tasted great. And with their help, we built the winery in Philo, planted more vineyards. In 1995, you know, basically we're hitting our stride. We're making a little bit of money. We're getting great accolades everywhere. And it was great. But at the same time, they had gone through some financing and needed to buy out all the little investors in their all their little projects, which was like, you know, Christian Dior and Kenzo and a whole bunch of more fashion brands. But they asked me what I wanted for my remaining shares of stock. And I thought, well, and so I came up with a number that was seemed a lot like a lot to me, and they said sure. And so I was basically allowed, like, free. I have no debt, had enough money to buy a little piece of property and build a house in Philo, and thinking I could retire.
But John didn't retire. Far from it. There was a big second act to come. He was about to launch Scharfenberger Chocolate, Julia Child's favorite chocolate in the world. Yes, that Julia Child. If you're just joining us, this is Kate Magruder, and you've been listening to my interview with John Scharfenberger. Let's dive back in.
Meanwhile, a good friend of mine who was in Mendocino County for a while, Robert Steinberg, I met up with him, and he had had a sort of a bad diagnosis health-wise, and he said he was going to die of cancer, you know, sometime in the next little while. He and another guy came up with an idea of making chocolate. So they fiddled around with it for a few months. And then I ran into Robert on the street, actually. And he said, you know, we're having a hard time getting going with this. Can you come and take a look at it? Help us with our business plan. And they had the thing started. But when I heard of the idea of chocolate, I said, you know, I eat chocolate every day. And I, you know, when I come back from France, I buy chocolate from different, you know, manufacturers. I know the brands and I know the different ones, and it's not done in the United States. So I said, you know, Robert, I'd love to help you. It was really fun. And so I basically did what I knew how to do, which is set up a little company, find a space, get the machinery ordered and put in place, which is basically old stuff that we were buying out of junkyards and having refurbished. Robert had some great resources in the cacao world. And so we were starting to bring in really lots of cocoa beans or cacao. And we started tasting them in his apartment. I said, look, the only way, this is not gonna be a mess because there's so many ambient flavors. We have to remove ourselves from this building. We need to roast everything exactly the same. We need to keep it in like a white thing. We need to grind it up exactly the same way and just do exactly what I learned to do in the wine business, is treat this like a real protocol of how you go about this. And then when we started tasting, you know, it's pretty hard to, when you taste, everything's kind of all over the board. You know, it's like bitter and sweet and fruity, all kinds of things. So I said to then Robert, I said, look, we've got to use the format that I had learned in the wine world of what's the physiology of the taste experience? What forms that? And over time, basically, you take a bite of chocolate and it's cold and then it starts to melt and then it's slightly sour and then it's a little bit tart and sour. And then the sugar starts to kick in and then so that becomes fruitiness. And then that fruitiness starts to really build until some of the tannins start showing up. And then the fat causes this late middle palate, and then suddenly the remaining tannins just rinse your palate and you're ready for another bite. But this is something that happens over time, and there's different chemicals and different characteristics that are affected by physical things all along the way. So when you're figuring out what you're blending with, you have to understand the conditions of the beans, what are they like, what are they good for, and then when you're tasting it, try and put together basically the scripts, like a 5-second script, but you can kind of follow it and it works really well. So that's what I knew, and that's what, you know, I taught him how to do it, and that's what we did. So over the years, you know, I mean, we used that, and luckily we stumbled into a lot of the right stuff, and we were pretty well situated in San Francisco. Robert knew tons of chefs. I knew a lot of wine and food writers from the champagne business and the wine business. And so we were able to, you know, I could walk up to Julia Child and give her a bite. And she'd say, darling, it's really good. It tastes like the chocolate I grew up with. She actually ate a lot of Scharfenberger till her last days. She was still getting a pound a week sent to her by a friend. So Robert and I, you know, we were both perfect for the situation. So we sort of divided up our duties and everything worked well. And, you know, the company grew like crazy when Google was just getting started. If you Googled chocolate, 5 of the top 10 hits were Scharfenberger. in the world. That's pretty good. We realized that what we had done is share these ideas with everybody. And because we shared our understandings of flavor and a manufacture of chocolate, and also its context and history, its historical context, but also its environmental context, which is really interesting as well, that people liked to write about us. And because we had the answers, we were written about. Whereas most of the other companies, everything's like a secret. Well, there's no secrets. You just tell everybody your secrets and they love you. Anyway, so we were growing really well. We were starting to make a little bit of money. And again, we had to find investors for that as well. And then these guys came to the food show in San Francisco, and they just came by and said hello. And they were, you know, kind of these guys wearing suits, which is kind of unusual at that food show. But then they were all from Pennsylvania. They had their tags turned into their chest, so we couldn't figure out who they were. And it was a group of people from Hershey. So they said, can you spend some time with us maybe, you know, tomorrow? And so we made a date and we went and sat with them. And they just, you know, they said, you know what, you guys are doing an amazing job. You know, they told us the Google thing. It's like, we're not even in the top 30. Hershey wasn't. So they said, would you be interested in kind of selling your company? And I said, no, I've got the best job in the world. I'd spent the Friday before actually in a whole bunch of chocolate ice cream trials with Haagen-Dazs. It was like really fun. So anyway, we stayed friends, and they came back and actually doubled the price they had mentioned the first time a few weeks later. And we started thinking about it, and Robert's health was getting worse. So that was a lot of it. He was not able to spend as much time, and it wasn't quality time always with us. So I knew he had some interests, and I started thinking, you know, I love what I'm doing, but I'm going to have to find a replacement for myself anyway. So within about 3 or 4 months, I asked them, I said no, and they doubled the price again. So it was pretty hard to say no. So we sold the company, and the people were wonderful. Hershey, you know, is run by a foundation for underprivileged kids, and they're really good at marketing to the like lower tercile of American demographics. So they basically, you know, said, John, thanks a lot. We'll continue. We'll take it from here. Robert helped them a bit on some blending, and then they actually rehired me to go all around the world to all of the farms that we bought from. So I went to 120 farms in 22 countries around the world. It was so much fun to meet all the different growers that grew for us, and it was such an amazing group of people, and it taught me a lot about the problems with the farming. The farming does not have to be poor. You just have to be smart. The Vietnamese can make from the same hectare, they can make $8,000 a hectare. And in South America, they can only make $400. It's like, what? It's with the same stuff. They just don't know how to do it. They weren't taught. And because these things are things that, you know, weren't indigenous to these communities. Whereas the Vietnamese said, well, nothing's indigenous here. We have to learn about it. So they studied it. And so they did really wonderful things to be able to have good crops, but also quality crops. So Vietnam is like up and coming for chocolate. I think they're going to really kick it.
As you look at your life, because you came here to Mendocino County and planted yourself here and have operated from this place, how has that shaped you, do you think?
I think the whole period of my formative years here in Mendocino County, which are still going on, there was an ethos here that was shared, I think, by the people who moved here. And a lot of that ethos was the reasons we headed this way. And we've just kept them with us. I mean, in terms of how you do business with other people, how you deal with government issues, how you do everything. And so it's that ethos that was, it was taken with me. And I luckily had it reaffirmed, you know, with my partners in the champagne business. But then, you know, Robert and I had those same ethoses when we went to work. So we paid everybody fairly, and you know, we had a fairly non-hierarchical system of working, and so those things we took with us, and they're things that really we didn't do them for marketing reasons. We never told people that we were, you know, paying double fair trade, but we just did it because it was the right thing to do. So I think that's really what I've taken with me, and I work for tons of little companies now, and it's really fun to see how smaller and younger companies are embracing all of these different things. And I think it's nice to see how proper manufacturing thoughts are kind of going into everything, whether it be fish farming or tofu making or sauerkraut production, all the things I'm involved with. So this is the new growth of food. And so that's what I'm really gratified by, is I'm just part of a group of people that are doing things well and producing products that needed to be improved. So we're making things that taste better and are better for you and are still, you know, affordable. And that's that. It's a wonderful thing to be part of that movement.
So how do you think that movement, the fact that so many people came here and so many people stayed here, how has that shaped the county?
Well, when I look around at the people that are here, especially in Anderson Valley, it's probably more my focus than other places. You know, basically everybody here who does anything is from that group of people. We're the majority now. People with those ethos kind of run the place in this valley. You know, there's a lot of change that needs to be done, but I think that the proportion of people that have ethos that are, you know, very positive are here. And over the years, we're just going to continue to make a bigger and bigger part of it.
Do you have a sense of what could still happen? There's lots of people still here, like you, who have still years to be here and to be putting things into practice. What might be waiting for us to do?
I think you really have to look at what's here, what's simple about here. There's a housing crisis in this area. It is not proper housing. And so that's my new project, is to develop worker housing that's affordable and safe and clean. And looking at the business part of it, is you make just as much money making houses for farm workers as you do for rich people. I mean, it's a lot easy to do. So I think there's a lot of challenges getting the government to be a little bit more proactive in this line, but it doesn't. It's still, the numbers are there and the numbers work. So if I was a kid coming here, I'd get to work building houses for people, and I'd get to work growing things, because I know kids who, you know, with basically a spade and a van are making $50,000 an acre growing food for restaurants. You know, just it's not hard. You just have to do it. And I think a lot of people aren't simple enough about it. They're always looking at, it has to be this thing and it has to be part of this program. The program has to be part of that program and da da da. And really, frankly, just building and growing and making for people is really, I think, the quickest way to improve things, and probably is the right thing to do.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I love living here. And I've lived here for, you know, since 1973, and I'm going to live here for a lot longer. And it's wonderful to look out my window and see trees that I've been looking at for the last 20 years. And in those 20 years, they've grown 30 feet higher than they were. And they were big trees then. So you see these trees here. It used to be, I can measure them against my house, and now the bigger ones have gotten huger. It's really a pleasure to be part of that, you know, kind of witness to landscape growth. It's really, really, that's my biggest pleasure.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. I'm Kate Magruder. We've just heard from John Scharfenberger of Philo, who helped put Mendocino County on the map by producing the first sparkling wines in Anderson Valley. He then went on to create a world-renowned gourmet chocolate with his partner Robert Steinberg. You can catch short excerpts of the Promise of Paradise interviews during the news hour on Thursdays at 7:45 and 8:45 a.m., and half-hour episodes at 3:30 on Thursday afternoon. You can find photos of John Scharfenberger on the KZYX website, as well as all the interviews we've aired as part of this project. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, Story Center, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.